It is Thursday, February 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump says only the most adept teachers should carry guns in schools. United Nations officials appeal for a truce in Syria's besieged East Ghouta.
So they're very confident that they can get away with what they're doing. Russia will veto any Security Council resolution that they don't like.
And the new hit film Black Panther offers African Americans a chance to connect with their roots. It's all ahead. On Thursday, U.S. President Donald Trump refined his gun control views. He said he wants only the most trained 20% of teachers to carry concealed weapons to stop school massacres. Trump said he will be strongly pushing comprehensive background checks of gun buyers, raising the age to buy assault-style rifles from 18 to 21, and ending the sale of bump stocks that increase the firepower of some weapons. Last week, a man armed with an AR-15 assault-style rifle gunned down 14 students and three adults at a high school in Parkland, Florida, setting off a storm of protests over school safety in the U.S. Trump also praised Wayne LaPierre and Chris Cox, two officials at the National Rifle Association, the country's top gun lobby that's opposing almost every restriction that gun opponents have advanced in the aftermath of last week's rampage. LaPierre defended his organization during a speech to the Conservative Political Action Conference, which is meeting just outside Washington.
Just a week ago, we were all horrified by another terrible tragedy at an American school. Each and every member of the National Rifle Association mourns the loss of the innocent and continues to keep their families and that community in our prayers. We share a goal of safe schools, safe neighborhoods, and a safe country. As usual, the opportunist wasted not one second to exploit tragedy for political gain. Saul Alinsky would have been proud. The breakback speed of calls for more gun control laws and the breathless national media eager to smear the NRA.
LaPierre also said security needs to be tightened at schools.
It's a bizarre fact that in this country, our jewelry stores all over this country are more important than our children. Our banks, our airports, our NBA games, our NFL games, our office buildings, our movie stars, our politicians. They're all more protected than our children at school. Does that make any sense to anybody?
On Wednesday, CNN staged a town hall event in Florida that included survivors of last week's shooting. Florida Senator Marco Rubio told the audience he does not support arming teachers and defended his acceptance of more than $3 million in political campaign donations from the NRA. Under questioning by students, parents, and teachers, Rubio also said tighter gun laws alone will not prevent future shootings, while he does support a minimum age for buying rifles and a ban on the bump stocks that can allow some weapons to shoot more bullets more quickly. A Washington Post ABC News poll released this week said 86% of respondents who identified themselves as Democrats said stricter gun control laws could have prevented the Florida shooting, while 67% who identified as Republicans said stricter laws could not have prevented the massacre. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, Sarah, it can be no surprise to you or to our listeners, I imagine, that social media has really been pretty roiled up lately in the wake of a number of news events. Of course, we also have the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee Conference, going on in Washington now, the fallout from the shooting in Parkland, the continued process, I suppose, of the Russian collusion investigation and just other things. People really seem to be unhappy out there, and especially conservatives really seem to be unhappy. Now, this week, Twitter engineers launched a campaign to root out what they call Twitter accounts and bot accounts. These are basically, people aren't really behind them. They're just kind of set up. They run on their own algorithms. They're not really, it looks like somebody's out there tweeting, but it really isn't. So they started this campaign, and they're removing a lot of these fraudulent accounts. Now, it just so happens that a number of these fraudulent accounts are those that follow what you could call alt-right, I suppose, conservative activists, people like James O'Keefe. James O'Keefe this week on Wednesday, and he's continued today, he's been tweeting it out, for example, quote, "Looks like thousands of Twitter users committed the thought crime of tweeting about God, the American flag, guns, and were taken off the platform. Our undercover reporting into Twitter showed those terms indicate to engineers you are for sure a bot." Now, that's not true. But nonetheless, the hashtag Twitter lockout is trending. It's trending among a lot of, again, conservatives. Dan Bonino, who's a frequent Fox News commentator, "I woke up and saw I lost almost 100 or so followers. Adrian Cohen, first time," pardon me, I'm sorry, "first time this has ever happened. Are conservatives being targeted like the IRS?" So a lot of people kind of upset. Now, Twitter says, look, we're not censoring anybody. This is apolitical. We're just simply trying to, one, reduce the number of bots that are out there and reduce how people post automated accounts. That can be, say, an account that you or I have, but you can set it up so that it just automatically retweets, you know, from various accounts. And what you end up getting is a really kind of distorted sense as to, you know, what people are individually are saying out there. Discussions can sometimes be hijacked. So they've tried to change. They're changing their algorithms for this. But again, the conservatives are not at all happy. And some of them have even taken the step to moving over to a brand new social media. It's called Gab. GAB.AI, excuse me. It is, you know, it's they say it's ad-free, you won't be charged for it. But there's some odd things about Gab. For example, its logo is the face of a frog. Now, that may not mean anything necessarily, but Pepe the Frog has kind of become a symbol in some ways, hijacked by the alt-right. Also, I just did a search for Gab real quick. This is what I'll end on. And Google tells me, well, people who searched for Gab also searched for Drudge Report, The Gateway Pundit, Breitbart News, and The Daily Stormer. So these are all highly conservative, in some cases, really far, far right conservative. So you get a sense as to what's going on. It seems some conservatives are saying they've had enough with Twitter. We'll see if it stands the test of time.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Amnesty International, in its latest report, says the politics of fear and hate are being normalized by some leaders. A deadly landslide has occurred in Indonesia. China denies contacts with separatist militants in Pakistan, and some of the missing Nigerian schoolgirls are rescued. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The World Health Organization considers cardiovascular disease to be the number one killer in the world, and among the top risk factors for heart disease is obesity. A recent study led by researchers from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Maryland suggests that losing weight may not be as important as the number of years a person was overweight or obese regarding their risk of heart disease. The researchers say the number of years someone spends overweight or obese can combine to form a distinctive risk factor for so-called silent heart damage. The study suggests that sustaining a healthy weight across one's life is important for keeping the heart healthy and reducing damage as people get older. The researchers point out that their study was only designed to illuminate possible relationships between long-term obesity and heart disease. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a controversial immigration bill poses a key test for French President Emmanuel Macron. In Syria, witnesses said Syrian and Russian warplanes are at it again Thursday, bombing the rebel-held Damascus suburbs in eastern Ghouta, besieged for 5 years, where hundreds have been killed and wounded since Sunday. The UN Security Council is expected to take up a draft resolution calling for a 30-day ceasefire to allow humanitarian aid in and the medical evacuation of hundreds of civilians. Secretary General Antonio Guterres is appalled by the carnage.
400,000 people that live in hell on earth. And so my appeal to all those involved is for an immediate suspension of all war activities in eastern Ghouta, allowing for humanitarian aid to reach all those in need, allowing for the evacuation of an estimated 700 people that need urgent treatment that cannot be provided there, and creating also the possibility for the other civilians to be effectively treated in the site.
Anthony Billingsley, senior Middle East lecturer at the University of New South Wales in Australia, tells International Edition's Victor Beattie what he thinks is behind this assault.
Assad's sense that he's winning, and given the Russians' involvement in this appalling process, that the Russian commitment is strong. There is an element to which Putin has been very pragmatic over the Syrian conflict and Middle Eastern issues generally. But here he seems to be digging in with the Syrians. So they're very confident that they can get away with what they're doing. Russia will veto any Security Council resolution that they don't like. And without wanting to diminish the appalling nature of what the Syrian government is doing, the other side is also lobbing mortars and things into Damascus. For the Syrian government to allow rebels to continue to attack it from such a close area is something that they can't tolerate. And it seems that they've just gone for the all-or-nothing approach to just blast everybody out, perhaps trying to force civilians to try to escape if they can.
They're likening this to Aleppo, where they negotiated a rebel withdrawal. Is that likely what will happen in eastern Ghouta?
I suppose that's possible, but where are they going to withdraw to? I mean, they've now turned their attention to Idlib, which was where all the rebels from Aleppo were relocated. You know, you can't send these people to Idlib province. Where are they going to go?
Further north in Syria, Turkey warned Wednesday that pro-Damascus forces would face, quote, serious consequences for entering Syria's Afrin region to help Kurdish fighters repel a Turkish offensive. How serious a matter is this?
This is the most extraordinary turn of events, isn't it, where you have a foreign country invading another country and telling that country for its armed forces to keep out. That country, which the US and others has condemned, is talking about protecting Kurds who happen to be allies of the United States. Talk about a complicated mix of alliances and loyalties. I suspect that the Syrian government is happy enough to go after rebels, but when it comes to the very significant armed forces that Turkey can bring to bear and the much more complex relationship that exists between Turkey and the United States and others, for example, that they're probably going to make a show, but it's hard to imagine that they would take on the Turkish armed forces.
Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales. France's Emmanuel Macron faces one of the biggest tests to date in his young presidency, as his cabinet is examining controversial immigration legislation before parliamentary debate. A record 100,000 people asked for asylum in France last year, and like elsewhere in Europe, public opinion has soured against migrants. For VOA, Lisa Bryant in Paris takes a look at what it means for migrants and for the government.
A metro rumbles overhead as a small group of migrants stomp their feet to stay warm on a cold morning. They're standing in front of a northeastern Paris office that processes asylum applications.
I came to take a refugee. I want to live here. I want to save a place. My husband, my government has make it problem with me.
46-year-old Abdelkader is an engineer from Jordan who crossed Egypt, Libya, the Mediterranean, and Italy before arriving here 3 weeks ago. His story is not completely clear, but he says he faces danger if he returns home.
No plan, only I want to take the paper. If the police catch me, make trouble with me. I need paper.
If French authorities find Abdelkader's story credible, he might benefit from proposed immigration legislation. It aims to speed up processing of asylum claims and make it easier for minors to get asylum status. But it would also toughen treatment for so-called economic migrants, sometimes doubling their time in detention centers and introducing jail sentences and fines for those crossing borders illegally to get here.
Calais n'est pas une porte d'entrée dérobée vers l'Angleterre. Et je veux être ici très clair.
French President Emmanuel Macron defends this mixed approach as firm and fair. He visited the port city of Calais last month, where a massive migrant squatter camp known as the Jungle was demolished in 2016. Macron vowed there would never be another jungle, although several hundred migrants are still camped out in Calais. A recent poll also shows most French believe there are too many immigrants here. But critics call the new legislation overly harsh. They include some members of Macron's own The Republic on the Move party, which includes politicians from the right and left. Some say it violates basic human rights. Louis Georgetin, who heads an umbrella association representing Black French, says deterring immigration also doesn't make economic sense.
The best people from Africa, from Europe, from all over the world go in many other places now. So I don't know why we're doing that. We're losing image, we're losing expertise, we're losing human resources, we're losing our own identity.
The group of asylum seekers does not seem aware of the fierce debate over their future. A man who identified himself as Shinwari from a part of Afghanistan with the same name says after failing to get asylum in Austria, he's trying France.
Do you hear about the President Macron has a new immigration law he's trying to get passed? Have you heard about that?
Yeah, we heard. Therefore, I came because everybody say he's a good man. And, we have hope here now.
A few minutes later, police arrive to get the men to move on. Their final destination remains up in the air. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Black Panther is a certified Hollywood blockbuster, raking in more than $200 million in North America during its opening weekend, setting several records. As VOA's Kane Faraba reports, the film's success comes as no surprise to the fans that pack theaters on the south side of Chicago to celebrate a film that marks a welcome departure from the Hollywood norm.
Nine-year-old Akilah Jaco has not yet watched Black Panther, but she already knows something about the movie.
There is a black superhero. There's a lot of people like us, and there's a lot of black children in the movie.
Jaco was among hundreds of students from the Betty Shabazz International Charter School that turned a showing of Black Panther at the Studio Movie Grill Theater on Chicago's South Side into a celebration of African culture and heritage.
We want to see this. We support this. We encourage that more of this is accepted.
Tahira Cartman says it's long past due for such a film.
It's 2018. We've had a black president. We shouldn't be just still having slavery movies. You know, we've seen those stories. We need to see more positive stories.
This film is a major departure as far as the types of roles that black actors are given and the types of storylines that we see black characters in the midst of.
Professor Blair Davis focuses some of his classes at DePaul University and his own study on the impact of comic book characters on pop culture. He believes Black Panther will be remembered as more than just a superhero film.
The best films, I think, we remember because they say something bigger. They say something about who we are as people, and I think the cultural aspects of Black Panther are what are going to allow us to remember it in years to come. So I think that it will succeed on its own merits as an action film, but I think that thanks to the talent of Ryan Coogler, that this will have a lasting value as this sort of perhaps sea change in Hollywood.
And it's a vision of black people in power and of black people having control over their own destiny.
Carol Lee is one of the founders of the Betty Shabazz International Charter School.
We're an African-centric school.
She says while Black Panther is a fictional film, it reinforces what they teach.
It's tapped the spirit, and that's why people are coming out in such numbers, bringing their children, dressing in ways, cultural ways of affirming. Yes, we are very clear about who we are.
It's definitely affecting the way our children, you know, see themselves and affect who they want to be and who they look up to, who they aspire to be. All of that definitely matters.
For Akila Jaco, even before she took her seat to see the film for the first time, Black Panther was already teaching her an important lesson.
You know, it says, like I said, like, anything's possible.
It is also possible Black Panther could become one of the highest-grossing films of all time. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Chicago.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nigeria's health, education, agriculture, and governance sectors will get an extra assist from the United States. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, announced $89 million in additional development assistance to Nigeria to continue its support for development goals outlined in a Development Objectives Assistance Agreement between the U.S. and Nigerian governments signed in 2015. Nearly half of the new funding, $44 million, will support HIV/AIDS control through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. The remainder will help Northeast Nigeria increase agricultural productivity, economic growth, and resilience through the U.S. government's Feed the Future initiative, strengthen education, support good governance, and improve water and sanitation infrastructure. The new funding brings the total U.S. government assistance provided under the five-year assistance agreement to $808.5 million. USAID collaborated with the Nigerian Ministry of Budget and National Planning, the Nigerian Ministries of Health, Agriculture, Power, and Education, and state-level government counterparts, among others, to structure the bilateral assistance agreement, which runs through 2020. In addition to the development assistance funding, the United States provides humanitarian assistance to people affected by the ongoing conflict and severe food insecurity in Nigeria and throughout the Lake Chad Basin. The U.S. government, led by USAID, has provided more than $526.7 million in humanitarian assistance since 2017 and continues to be the single largest bilateral humanitarian donor to the region. This new assistance underscores how important the relationship between Nigeria and the United States continues to be. USAID Nigeria Deputy Assistant Administrator Julie Conan said, "Our strong partnership with Nigeria and its institutions will help Nigeria's efforts to improve its health, education, agriculture, and governance systems where they are needed most throughout the country."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.